from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour, we talk to the woman responsible for bringing one fabulous British TV series after another to the public television screens of America. Rebecca Eaton is the gal who gave the green light to Downton Abbey, Sherlock, and Prime Suspect, the one starring Helen Mirren. Rebecca Eaton has been at the helm of the PBS series Masterpiece for more than 25 years, a series that was arguably getting long in the tooth when she took it over and remodeled it for a new generation. As one pundit put it, not since Ken Burns' documentary The Civil War has PBS been at the center of national cultural conversation as it is now. Rebecca Eaton is with us on Forum. This is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Executive producer Rebecca Eaton has been at the helm of the PBS series Masterpiece for more than 25 years. Her most recent successes include Downton Abbey and Sherlock. We'll talk to Eaton about how she picks winners like Prime Suspect, starring Helen Mirren, and adapts classics like Bleak House and Pride and Prejudice. We'll also discuss what it takes to modernize one of television's oldest brands. Rebecca Eaton, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Well, I guess my first question is, how do I get your job? How did you get your job?
Well, it was so long ago, I'm not sure I can remember how I got it.
Well, you were an English major, right?
I was, and you were too.
Yes.
So the first thing is be an English major. No, I was very lucky. I have been incredibly lucky in my life and my career because I fell into public broadcasting by wanting to live in England. That's all I wanted to do growing up. I read all these books and was just a complete Anglophile living in Pasadena, California. And there was a program at my college which sent two graduates a year to work at the BBC in London. So I just took the job. I didn't know what BBC even stood for. I just wanted to live in London and go to the theater. So I went. And then one thing, as so often happens, leads to another. And I was there for a year and a half, came back just at the moment that NPR was starting. PBS had gone on the air a year or two before. This is 1971. And I volunteered at WGBH in Boston and started producing an art show. And it was the year that All Things Considered was born. So I cut my teeth in radio and then got a job in television and had a meteoric rise to the top in 17 years to become the executive producer of Masterpiece.
So it's all about timing then?
It's about, I think in my case it was, that I kind of came to public television just at the beginning and have been able to ride the fantastic wave.
You jumped into the top spot eventually at Masterpiece Theater and Mystery, which was already quite an amazing program. I'm wondering if you can bring up some of our younger listeners up to speed with what that history was about.
Well, I started producing Masterpiece in its 15th year. It was already very successful. It was one of the most successful shows on public broadcasting. And it had started in 1971 as the showcase for classic British drama. Upstairs, Downstairs was one of the first series that we did. We did I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi, long 12-13 week historical dramas, adaptations of literature, Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina. And it was the only game in town in those days. It was before miniseries had really appeared on commercial television. And people were starving for quality drama. So I came in really at the first peak of Masterpiece's success. It's had several peaks over its 40, now 2 years. But it was just after we had aired a show called The Jewel in the Crown, which was hugely popular. And I would recommend to anybody rent the DVDs or stream it or read the books because it's the story of the British in India. in the 1930s and 40s.
Fabulous series, fabulous book. You know, I think I must have been in diapers when I first saw Alistair Cook introducing.
Rachel, this is terrible. You're making me feel
Masterpiece
150
Theater.
Years old.
But for the benefit of those who may have stopped watching a long time ago, here's what you hear and see. You know, should you tune into Masterpiece Classic today, what you hear and see is Laura Linney. We've got a little clip of her introducing the show.
I'm Laura Linney, and this is Masterpiece Classic.
It's a classy choice, Laura Linney. I think most people would agree. You know, sticking with the old music, and I'm hoping this will lead us into a discussion about how you managed to sort of spruce up a long in the tooth series.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wonder if your listeners can tell that the old Masterpiece theme, which if I could sing, if I could carry a tune in a basket, I would hum it. But the old Masterpiece theme is actually in the new Masterpiece theme. And Laura is as elegant and as smart an actress as you could possibly imagine. I can't remember, maybe it's 5 or 6 years ago, Masterpiece was kind of in the valley of the shadow. The ratings had gone down. The funding was down. There was tons of competition. People were talking about it as the show they used to watch or that their parents had watched.
Or they watched in diapers.
And I thought, I can't be the captain on whose watch this ship goes down. We have to do something. I didn't know what to do. I don't know anything about branding or rebranding. And it might have been a blessing that I didn't, because rebranding a classic like Coke, for instance, is a really dangerous thing to do. You run the risk of alienating your very faithful fans, and that's what Masterpiece had. And you run the risk of throwing away millions of dollars to try to attract new people who basically won't be attracted. So, not knowing any of that, we were able to get a little bit of money from PBS and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a very little bit of money, and we did our own research. We basically hired a wonderful branding expert named Bob Knapp and said, don't give us any malarkey. Don't give us any mission statements, any expensive ideas. We need really doable advice. He did. He went out. We gave him a list of about 100 names of people who were fans, critics, potential funders, former funders, public television executives, newspaper writers, and said, go speak to them, promise them anonymity, and come back and tell us what's right and what's wrong about what we're doing, which they did. They spoke very candidly, and what we got back was, you have a dusty jewel that's hard to find. We love it. We love the stories. We love the programs when we get into them, but you're scaring people off by calling it Masterpiece Theater. You're giving us head snaps every week by 1 week being Jane Tennyson, you know, in Prime Suspect, the next week Jane Austen. You never know what you're going to get. So we took a deep breath and redid the kind of window dressing of Masterpiece. We redid the themes. Different hosts came in, Laura Linney for Classic, Alan Cumming, the wonderful Alan Cumming for Mystery. And we put the show in genres. So for one part of the year, you will watch nothing but classics. If you love Petticoats and Teacups and adaptations of literature, for the rest of the year, you will watch the mysteries, which have an equally fanatic audience. And we were blessed. The critics understood immediately what we were doing. They wrote about it. The audience read what the critics were writing. They tuned in. They loved it. And we had unwittingly set the stage for what would become our rebirth with some big hits like Sherlock and Downton Abbey.
Big hits. You know, anybody who's a fan of British drama in any genre knows that England, the British Isles, they're a machine. They're churning out, you know, TV show after theater piece after film with a lot of stalwarts. We recognize some, we don't. How do you go about choosing the ones that are going to resonate with American audiences?
I have no idea how I do that. I say that jokingly, but it is very subjective. We don't do focus groups. I read scripts all the time. I go to London a lot, meet with writers and producers and directors. And over these 25 years, I've gotten to know who the good people are, who the people are who can deliver, whose instincts are right. So when we come in early, as we often do, we might come in as a co-producer based on just an idea or a treatment before a word has been written. I get to know who's going to do them. And then I have a sense of the audience, because the audience, I think, is largely me, people like me, which is not to say that I program just for myself, but we know the demographic research that we do, that people who watch public television to begin with, and then more specifically who watch Masterpiece, are people with a college degree, people with a passport, people with a little bit of disposable income, discerning viewers who like to read, who like to go to the movies, who like quality. So I have learned to sort of trust my gut, which I was afraid to do at the beginning. I thought, well, I like it, but I don't know if anyone else will. Not, which is not to say I haven't made some huge mistakes thinking people might like it, something which they didn't, and I'm not going to tell you which shows, because I know you're going to ask me which shows those were.
You never chose a turkey, or rather you don't want to name any names?
No, I did choose a couple of turkeys. There were some shows in there, and other shows I took because my vision was clouded by either really liking the producer and thinking this person can do a good job, or, you know, maybe we came in before it was cast, and it might have been miscast, so...
What do you say to people who ask, naturally, why is there so much British television on American public television?
Ah, that's a very good question. It has to do, I think, with money, the economics. The economics of Masterpiece are this, that back in 1971 when it started, some people at WGBH, my station, realized there was a ton of already made British drama at the BBC. This was just after the Forsyte saga, and the Forsyte saga actually wasn't on the BBC, but just after that, the people at GBH realized there's more to be seen here. Then there was A Marriage Made in Heaven with a very big oil company, Mobil Oil, and a genius there named Herb Schmertz, who realized that if Mobil supported this classy series on public television, he would be able to reach a lot of movers and shakers who would be important to Mobil, and might even reach people who were deciding where to fill up. You know, should we go to this gas station or that gas station? Let's go to Mobil because they're classier, because they do this British drama. So that's how British drama started on PBS. There is an affinity between PBS and the BBC, and they're both public broadcasters, and PBS is in many ways made in the fashioned after the BBC. However, it is not funded as the BBC is. The BBC is extremely well funded because there's a license fee for every household that owns a television. It's a tax, and they have billions of dollars in revenue, which of
so
course...
So we're essentially piggybacking on their system?
Well, on their taste, on their objective, on their mission, but not on their financial system. So, and Masterpiece took off. It was so popular. And for a long time, it was the only British drama on around. And then because I think of the success of Masterpiece, other networks have become interested. And certainly since the success of Downton Abbey, I think everybody in this country is looking at the makers of Downton Abbey, the actors, or is there anything else like it coming through? PBS now has an 8 o'clock Sunday night show called Call the Midwife, which people may have seen, which has boosted the Sunday night ratings terrifically. Bletchley Circle comes at 10 o'clock. So Sunday night is becoming British drama night, which is tremendous for us.
You know, you mentioned earlier that a lot of British drama falls into genres, easily recognized, mm-hmm. Crime dramas, petticoat and teacup dramas. I have to admit, before I saw the series, my presumption about Downton Abbey was that it looked an awful lot like Upstairs, Downstairs, mm-hmm. reheated and reserved. Mm-hmm. How did you know from just looking at the script that this was going to be something different, something special even?
I didn't, which is the little secret behind Downton Abbey. I really didn't. And we were, in fact, already co-producing the new Upstairs, Downstairs. We were deep into that. And that one looked like The Winning Horse because it was an absolute favorite among our audience. We were working with Jean Marsh and Eileen Atkins. The BBC was doing it. And then along comes The Dark Horse of Downton Abbey, and we did think this looks an awful lot like Upstairs, Downstairs, and we took our time in coming in as a co-producer.
What do you think accounts for the fact that it's turned into really a pop hit? This is well mm-hmm. beyond the English majors watching PBS.
You know, if we knew that, if we knew that, we would all do it again. William Goldman famously said, about Hollywood, nobody knows anything. It's true. It is some kind of, to use another cliche, a perfect storm of the quality of the show, the setting of the show, the need in the audience in England and here to have an entertainment like this, maybe in contrast to all the very hard-hitting, morally ambiguous, popular series that were going on, Boardwalk Empire, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, even Mad Men, to find a series which was as beautifully done and as good-hearted at its core as Downton Abbey is. Could be that.
I suppose, too, just amazing writers, directors, costume designers, casting directors. Let's hear a little bit of Downton Abbey. And just a generalized warning to listeners. You don't need to worry about a spoiler alert immediately, but they are probably coming, either from me or Rebecca Eaton or somebody in the listening audience. So let's hear now of Dowager Countess of Grantham, played, of course, by the terrific Maggie Smith.
Mama, may I present Matthew Crawley and Mrs. Crawley, my mother, Lady Grantham.
What should we call each other? Well, we could always start with Mrs. Crawley and Lady Grantham.
She's just... It's dripping with cheese, but she also kind of has a certain
cheese
moral authority. I don't know what it is.
She's Maggie Smith.
She is Maggie Smith.
Well, first, I have to correct something you said. There is one writer for Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes. He created it, and he is the only writer. He writes every word. He designs every scene, not physically, but he envisions every scene. I think he probably acts out every part as he's writing it, and none better than Maggie Smith. He and Maggie Smith have arrived together on some planet, and they don't need to speak. He can sense how a line would sound coming from Maggie, and he writes for her. So you have to hand it to Julian Fellowes. He is the guy. Carnival Films is the company that makes it in the UK. And they came to Julian after Gosford Park and said, he did the film, Gosford Park, for which he won an Oscar for the screenplay, and said, would you ever consider doing a television show? And he thought about it probably, virtually overnight and came back with 20 characters who he had just created in his head and the story of Downton.
Explain for us what it means to be the co-producer, the executive producer. What is it exactly you're doing with Julian and
Maggie? Giving them money.
Giving them money.
As the American co-producer, we are a minority funder of Downton, but we were the ones who made it possible in this country. It would have been made anyway, in the UK for ITV. This isn't BBC. It's actually on commercial television in England. And it would have been on anyway, but they wouldn't have had the complete budget. They would have been short some money, and it wouldn't have been seen in this country. So we were the original co-producers, which allowed it to be seen, and then it took off. And if we hadn't sewn it up for its life, it could have then gone on to NBC or to HBO. Everybody wanted it. But we had taken a chance on it. So what co-producing means. It's different for every show, depending on how much money we put in. But we read scripts, give script notes, see all cuts, have opinions about casting, not final say, suggestions for casting. And that's how Masterpiece has operated for its whole life. And I think after doing this for 40 years, I think the British producers respect what we have to say because we know the programming so well and we know what will work for an American audience.
You have a special relationship.
Yeah, special relationship. Yeah, coin that phrase.
So I guess that goes some way towards answering this next question, which is why we still need PBS in the mix when you already have ITV and BBC America and Amazon Prime. We're now living in a world where people can get their British TV fix without PBS.
Yes, they can. They have to pay for it. They have to watch it with commercials if they watch it on BBC America. And they don't get very much of it. Sporadically, they would get it. You know, eventually things will be available to buy. But public television, as you well know, is designed to make this material available for everyone free of charge. Of course, there is a very minimal amount of federal funding in the public television budget, and we depend on the kindness of strangers, people making contributions to their local stations. But, you know, I think Masterpiece's resurgence in the past few years with Downton, but not just Downton, with Sherlock, with Mr. Selfridge, I think it kind of represents a hunger in people for really smart drama, well-written, beautifully produced, beautifully cast and acted. There is a lot of it in this country. I think we're really in a golden age of drama, but it is often very hard-hitting, a lot of the other stuff. And not that Masterpiece programming is anodyne, but it has a certain it has a certain uplifting quality to it, even when the story is very dark, because there is so much care taken in the productions and the British acting is so impeccable.
I guess there's a certain kind of gentility in it.
Yes, but I mean, the British have a reputation for gentility, which is kind of ill-deserved. but it is more, it's not so much gentility as just perfection. There is a certain quality and amount of care put into these productions, which I think really, makes you feel better.
As you've mentioned before, you know, you weren't clear that Downton Abbey was going to be a monster hit, or for that matter, Sherlock or Prime Suspect, which had its own American remake. You've helped to bring tens of millions of viewers to PBS in recent years. And I'm wondering, has a commercial outfit like HBO or another private broadcaster ever tried to poach you?
I couldn't possibly comment. I've thought about that, but the amount of freedom I've had in this job, and it is so perfect for me, being an Anglophile, a bookworm, and having built up these relationships and being given a budget to spend on whatever I think is right, is too good to leave.
We're talking with Rebecca Eaton, who shepherded British television to the U.S. for more than 25 years. Several series have become monster hits on this side of the drink. What's your favorite? Let us know. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Rebecca Eaton, who, it must be said, did not write Downton Abbey and so is not technically responsible for the season 3 finale. I imagine we're going to be getting a lot of comments from listeners, people who are writing in. They already are, actually. Kate asks, I would love to hear Miss Eden talk about Endeavor. Was it exciting to return to such a beloved character in a younger state? Mm. I'll let you explain what Endeavor is for those
yes.
who are like, who is that?
Oh, good. No more, no Matthew questions right away.
They're coming.
Endeavor. Well, first of all, you have to remember Inspector Morse, which was a Colin Dexter mysteries that we did for years. John Thaw played Morse, and we never knew what his first name was. He was a melancholic, opera-loving, crossword-puzzle-doing policeman in the Thames Valley. And we did years and years of Morse. John retired and then sadly died. In the very last episode, he revealed his first name, which was Endeavor. He was raised by Quakers, and his name was Endeavor. So years went by. We missed John. And then Mammoth Films in the UK came up with the idea to do Morse the prequel and to come in on young Endeavor Morse just as he leaves Oxford and is a police constable. It would be the 60s. It would be a great era. Wonderful cars and costumes, and it would show how young Endeavor Morse became Inspector Morse. And it was a great idea. Colin Dexter loved it. He hadn't written any books, but he loved it. And we looked around and found Sean Evans to play Endeavor. So we did a pilot. It was hugely successful here and in the UK. He has the same melancholy, the same appeal to women who think this is such a lonely man, but I know how to make him feel better.
So that's what it is.
That's what it is. That's what it often is. You think of Mr. Darcy. Anyway, so we did that. It was so successful. We did 4 more, and there are more in the works.
How do you know when it's time to redo a series that's been done well before? I'm thinking both of Upstairs, Downstairs, but also Sherlock.
Well, I'm always amazed that the time to redo comes as early as it does, because I did think when Sherlock came across my desk, oh, we don't want to do this. Jeremy Brett was the perfect Sherlock. It's too soon for this. But I did remember that I had had the same feeling about Pride and Prejudice about 10 or 15 years ago, and that was a huge mistake because it went to A&E. So I was a little more careful this time. Plus, someone in my office, our wonderful Aaron Delaney, one of our producers, said, Rebecca, this Sherlock is going to be written by Stephen Moffat. And I said, who's Stephen Moffat? And she said, oh, my God. Stephen Moffat is the writer of Doctor Who and comes with a gigantic fan base. So I looked at the script a little more carefully, then looked at, they did a pilot for that as well, which was 60 minutes long, Benedict Cumberbatch, Martin Freeman. It was so good that the BBC decided not to air that pilot, but to go back and make it as a 90-minute show because they realized it could have gone on longer. So we came in then as a co-producer, thank God. And it has been, with Downton, another one of our tentpole hits.
And we're going to play a little bit of Sherlock now for the benefit of those who might be thinking, really? Really? Is it that good? Let's hear from the first episode of the first season. This is a scene in which Sherlock has just met Dr. Watson, who will, of course, become his sidekick.
When I met you for the first time yesterday, I said Afghanistan or Iraq. You looked surprised.
Yes, how did you know?
I didn't know. I saw. Your haircut, the way you hold yourself, says military. But your conversation as you entered the room...
A bit different from my day.
...said trained Bart, so army doctor, obvious. Your face is tanned, but no tan above the wrists. You've been abroad, but not sunbathing. Your lips really bad when you walk, but you don't ask for a chair when you stand like you've forgotten about it. So it's at least partly psychosomatic. That says the original circumstances of the injury were traumatic. Wounded in action, then. Wounded in action, suntan, Afghanistan or Iraq.
There again, just compelling.
That's
acting.
Benedict. Oh, yeah. Don't you love that voice? Benedict Cumberbatch, who's gone on to be just a huge, huge star. And that's Stephen Moffat's writing. Because just for people who haven't seen it, Dr. Watson is played by Martin Freeman, the young Dr. Watson. And he like Dr. Watson in the Conan Doyle books, is a veteran, and he walks with a cane and limp. And he and Sherlock become flatmates at 22B Baker Street. And they have a housekeeper. And all the similarities from the original book, but done in a modern way. So good.
Are there any books you haven't done that you're just dying to do?
Oh, interesting. Well, there are a lot of stories. The Eighth Day, Thornton Wilder's book, The Eighth Day. Everybody should look at that. It would be a wonderful American drama. See, I'm very interested in American stories. There's a wonderful biography of Mark Twain and his wife, Livy, which is such a classic story of love and romance and how one partner in a marriage can save the other, and then the things will shift completely and it will be the turn of the other to save the spouse. It's just a beautiful, beautiful story. I think there are lots of stories in American history that would make such great dramas if we were set up the way the BBC is to actually have the money to do those. They would be wonderful. So maybe.
Do you think that's feasible? I mean, given the success of shows like Sherlock and Downton Abbey?
It's costume drama, period costume drama, can cost $2.5 million an hour to make. So I don't know how. I don't know. I've thought about this for 25 years. I think it's not just the success of Downton Abbey, but all the new distribution possibilities. I think there are more possibilities there. So we think about them a lot. And the secret sauce to getting a British partner is to find an idea that has a British character in the United States or in America. So in other words, it wouldn't be an all-American show. There would be some camel's nose under the tent or a Trojan horse. For instance, we did do The Buccaneers, Edith Wharton's The Buccaneers years ago, which were about those Gilded Age daughters that the mothers and fathers had all the money but, you know, wanted a little class. So they married them off to the landed gentry in England who had land but no money. Just as Cora marries Robert in Downton Abbey, she was a buccaneer, her family fixed her up with Robert, and then happily they fell in love.
One of our listeners wants to bring us back to the question of turkeys. She tweets, just to warn you, brace yourself. She tweets, or he tweets, I have to admit, I don't really know, OMG, Mr. Selfridge bit so hard. and follows up to ask, you know, how do you handle shows that die? What are the repercussions? What are the lessons?
Well,
you take
first
from?
I have to say about Mr. Selfridge, that tweeter, notwithstanding, didn't bite that hard. He actually had very good ratings. The show performed very well, and we are doing a second season of it. It will be very different in the second season. Jeremy Piven plays Mr. Selfridge, and he came on as the brash American coming into the British culture and kind of taking it by storm. This is now 5 years on, and things are more subdued, and the stories are a bit more complex. So I think I would protest about Mr. Selfridge. There have been some. I remember a show we did. I shouldn't say that. Anyway, we did a show a long time ago about Cecil Rhodes, which I knew from the beginning we shouldn't be doing. Cecil Rhodes, the English, very rich man, started the Rhodes Scholarships, but he made his fortune in South Africa in the diamond mines. And I thought it was an interesting kind of British colonialism story, and it just sat there. Martin Shaw played Cecil Rhodes, and it didn't work. And we did actually Colin Firth, the gorgeous Mr. Darcy. We had Colin Firth in a Joseph Conrad book called Nostromo, which is set in South America. Actually, also in a mine. Maybe the mining.
It's the colonial thing, perhaps.
Maybe
sets
that
people
doesn't
off.
Work.
They'd rather just see the folks enjoying the fruits
of
oppression.
But that didn't move the needle. So you just get on with it.
Richard writes, the PBS audience generally enjoys Downton Abbey, but most of us are rather annoyed that U.S. audiences have to wait months see the shows after it's been. We're all waiting for season four.
Yes.
The Brits are already, enjoying it, but we have to wait till January.
Yes, I know. We hear about this a lot with Sherlock as well as with Downton. And we think about it all the time. We talk about it all the time. We try to figure out the pros and cons of moving the broadcast closer to the UK transmission. So I will just say this. Technically, it's complicated because there are different lengths and different formats in the UK. Yeah, okay, fine. But the truth of it is, with Downton, for instance, it airs in the UK in September and October, and we broadcast it in January. January and February is a very sweet spot for PBS and for Masterpiece. The audience numbers are very high. I don't know whether it's because the weather is bad and people are inside watching television and it's dark. To put it earlier, we would put Downton in the teeth of the storm. We would put it up against the premieres for all the network shows, and they have a lot of money and a very loud voice. And it is potentially a difficult time for a show. We have been asked by the critics constantly when we have done that, why did you air this show up against the premieres? It's stupid. Don't do it. So the question of spoilers, there are two things. The number of people who pirate the shows, people are saying, look, I can get this illegally. This is hurting you. Why would you do that? It turns out the numbers, the ratings for Downton when it airs in January and February have been going up every year. And the pirates aren't actually impacting the viewership. Our viewers don't tend to pirate or don't want to. The second thing is spoilers. I would say for all the people who were absolutely outraged and floored and surprised when Dear Matthew went under the car at the end of series three, give the lie to the fact that spoilers ruined the season, because I think many, many people didn't know. And people, the spoilers are out there. A lot of people consciously avoid them and just really try not to read them, or spoiler alert, and they really don't read on. Paula Kirger, who's the president of PBS, made a very good point. She said there are a lot of people who actually like the communal nature of knowing Downton at the same time. In other words, watching it either with a group of people on Sunday nights, or even, you know, getting them all together and binging on them, but doing it as a community. There is some kind of a let's do it at the same time feeling that speaks to keeping it on weekly, at least.
Do you think it's also the advent of social media that people really enjoy tweeting about TV programs as they're watching it?
Yes, there is that, which is, I have to say, a phenomenon which I find very difficult. I have such a one-track mind. I can do only one thing at a time. But I think that that's another way that people really love to talk to. And there is a tweeter with the handle Lady Mary's Eyebrows, which is, I think, fabulous.
Oh, so many different accounts. You should be letting us know, folks, listeners, what your favorite Twitter accounts are for Downton Abbey just alone. There's several. I can't even list them all now. Let's go to the phones now and talk to Bill in Burlingame.
Hi, this is Phil. You said that, great show, you said that you'd like to have an American show. I'd like to pitch an idea. How about a show called The Founders, which talks about the American Revolutionary Founders? There's a lot of drama, that went there. It's very topical because the GOP is always talking about what the Founding Fathers think, and I don't think that they're necessarily saying it right. And the John Adams three-part series was spectacularly successful. It's a period piece. It's got the costumes and Downton Abbey, but in an American way, and they do have British accents.
Yes, actually, it's a really good idea. I was going to say, they already did that. HBO did it with John Adams starring, of course, Laura Linney, our host, and Paul Giamatti, who is in Downton Abbey this upcoming season. Just a little plug. He plays Elizabeth McGovern's American brother. Shirley MacLaine is her mother, and Shirley and Paul come over to Downton Abbey. I would love to do something about our early days. I would love to do something about the Civil War. you have to find the right story, because John Adams worked, I thought, but I would think a fictional story based on true events would be wonderful, because I think the absolutely magic ingredient, so many masterpiece productions, is love and love affairs, the will they, won't they, the Romeo and Juliet, the emotional jeopardy. And you have to be careful when you're doing real events that it's not just a bunch of guys talking in a room. There has to be family drama, emotional drama. So I would love to do that. And you're absolutely right. The accents wouldn't be a problem. We could use British actors.
Phil, I think you have a career in Hollywood ahead of you. Or perhaps public broadcasting. I should mention, spoiler alert, although you have mentioned that Matthew meets an untimely end in Downton Abbey. Amanda asks, I understand you had to get rid of the character because the actor, his contract was up and he wanted to leave the show, but could it have not been handled better? She says there's no denouement whatsoever. Happy Matthew and Mary, who we should mention, take forever to get together originally. And then, boom, death and black screen. Ouch, she writes. Why?
It's so interesting that people don't like the way Matthew went. And as Julian Fellowes said, how else could he have gone? Would he and Mary have grown apart? Would he have gone off on a trip? If he had gone off on a trip, you would be waiting for him to come back endlessly. I don't know if the complaint is that there was no, that he was clearly dead and then there wasn't any time for the audience to mourn with the family. That for instance, you're watching it, he's dead, and that's the end of the show. And then you're sitting in there in your living room, and now what do you do, having been shown? It would have been more comforting to have what will be part of the beginning of season four, which is the family in mourning. Season four opens in 1922, February of 1922. It's about 6 months later. Mary and Isabel, Matthew's mother, are in mourning. And I think that it will help for the audience to be with them briefly. And maybe it could have helped if we had been with Mary when she heard the news. But oh my gosh, that would have been excruciating too. I don't know how we could have made people feel better about it.
Do you ever feel tempted as a producer to step in, or do you understand that that would be the end of the special relationship?
No. I trust Julian so much. He has such good instincts about this. I think everybody was very surprised when Dan Stevens said he really did have other things he wanted to do. But then Julian, this is a little bit making lemonade out of lemons, he said, and I think this is true, he says it's very hard to write happiness. And Matthew and Mary had found happiness. And so then what was interesting there, you know, they could have economic problems, they could have troubles with their kids, but nothing ever would be as dramatic as Will They, Won't They, and then Yes They Will, and having their baby. So now Mary is back on her own, and we have a lot of questions about what will happen to her, or will she find someone else? And there are a certain amount of number of gentlemen callers who come to Downton Abbey.
Maybe she could turn into some kind of black widow.
Well, she doesn't have a very good track record.
Exactly.
Poor Mr. Pamuk.
Perhaps Mr. Number Three is coming up.
People are going to be like of turning down invitations to come to Downton Abbey.
Well, this leads to a question actually from one of my colleagues here at KQED who says, Julian Fellowes seems to have just one story in him. Downton Abbey is recycled material right out of Gosford Park. Masters Ooh. Hiding secret affairs, servants hiding the fact they were conscientious objectors in World War I, gay servants, Maggie Smith as a tart-tongued preserver of the old guard. The Clash
wow.
of Britain.
This comes from inside this building. Who is this person?
I can't divulge his name.
Well, no. Julian, he had a good thing. Gosford Park was a really good idea. And he's very open about the fact that a lot of Gosford Park came from upstairs to downstairs. He knows Eileen Atkins and Jean Marsh, who are the creators of Upstairs Downstairs. It's his world. He knows this world. he is gentry himself, Julian. He loves history. He loves period drama, 19th century, earliest 20th century. He really, and I think that's why it's so good, because he writes what he knows and what he loves. I think there, you know, there are reasons some of these books are considered classics. You know, you can look at Madame Bovary, look at Anna Karenina, just changing the subject briefly, that there are probably only 10 good stories in the whole world. Often they are about unrequited love and betrayal and secrets and real estate and life and death and birth. So I just think he's tapped into something that he does really well. And
it's
and
a rich vein.
Godspeed, yeah.
Well, let's head back to the phones. And Nancy in Berkeley.
Hi. I believe I started watching Masterpiece Theater with the very first drama, and that was the first Churchills. And I have never left. I don't know what I would do on Sunday night without Masterpiece Theater or Masterpiece Mystery. And I just want to commend you on... There's been some that I haven't liked as well as others. Poldark was a great, great favorite in our family. My young daughter still talks about Poldark. In fact, we went to England and went and visited Cornwall so we could see where it was done. There's a couple programs on BBC that have not been picked up again. One about a newsroom that I thought was one of the best. And it would be really great if Masterpiece Theater could pick that one up. And my husband and I cried through Call the Midwife. That was just, that was unbelievable. So I just wanted to congratulate you.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful show.
Thank you. That's very nice of you. I tell you, there is another Poldark in the works. Nothing definite yet, but there is talk of redoing Poldark. First Churchill's was the very first show. And I think Call the Midwife, I'm amazed your husband loves it too, because there are a lot of men who can't watch it. Actually, it's a little bit too much about childbirth for them. But we've had a great time, and it is, there are a lot of people like you who watched Masterpiece with their families. It became a family affair.
Do you have? I know this is a terrible question to ask a mother with many children,
yes,
but
yes,
do you have
a
favorite?
I do. I have several favorites. I did love Bleak House. Before I had this job and I was watching Alistair Cook, you know, as a civilian, I did love Upstairs, Downstairs and Jewel in the Crown. And then when Bleak House happened, I just thought it was brilliant. The production values of it, the whole way they did it. And then I have quirky little favorites. We did a film with Judy Dench called Mrs. Brown, and she played Queen Victoria in mourning after Albert had died.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
And she fell in love with her gamekeeper, or she fell in something with her gamekeeper, who kind of brought her back to life. He was played by Billy Connolly, the Scottish comedian. And I just thought it was such an interesting film because it was about coming back to life when you're in deep mourning. It was about letting go of somebody you love and allowing yourself to feel again. I just thought that was a brilliant contribution and a little piece of history as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for the question. You know, going back, we were talking earlier about social media and the way that people now collectively experience television. What do you make of all the spoofs that you see being made of Masterpiece, classic, and mystery shows?
Well, P. Diddy. I don't know if you saw P. Diddy about being... he produced, for Funny or Die, a spoof. After we announced that there would be a black character coming into season 4, he produced this spoof. I spent a lot of money and time on it, inserting himself into past scenes in Downton Abbey and saying, actually, I was the first black character in Downton Abbey, which was priceless. We all loved that. My own favorite was I can't remember the name of it. There is a British charity that does spoofs. Red Nose Day is what they call it. And they produced a spoof of Downton Abbey. And my favorite moment was when Carson, and this is an actor playing Carson, asks Cora or something if he could get her a cup of tea. She says yes. And then it shows the actor going outside, getting in a car, driving 90 minutes away to actually where the kitchens of Downton Abbey are filmed in Ealing in London. The two sets are 90 minutes away, going into the kitchen, getting a cup of tea and getting 90 minutes coming back. Just a little kind of how this really works between Highclere Castle, where Downton Abbey is, and where, you know, where the other half of the cast is. So, no, there have been so many of them, and we have made reels of them and spoofs of the spoofs, and anything that floats the boat is fine with me.
We asked our listeners to share their favorites, and Katie, like you, loved, I believe it was Downton Abbey with Sean Puffy Combs. Colleen writes, Downton Abbey in Facebook updates. I guess apparently a lot of people are making hay on Facebook. Renee prefers the ones she's seen, Downtown Arby's
YouTube. Yes,
Arby's, mm-hmm. That's a good one. Andy says, Alistair Cookie Monster's Monsterpiece Theater was always near to his heart.
That was, that was ages ago. See, what's the good news about all this is that it's the younger audience, because the Masterpiece audience is generally older, but so many younger people have been brought in by Downton Abbey and by Sherlock. And what they are finding, what they're telling us, is then they stick around and watch the other shows and they realize this isn't so scary. You know, I can do this. And they get into them and it's forbidden love again. And off they go. And that's what we need.
Libby writes, as a big fan of Sherlock, I was delighted when the eighth graders at the school where I teach began enthusiastically chatting about how much they loved it, too. Bringing the generations together, we've been talking with Rebecca Eaton, executive producer of PBS's series Masterpiece. She's co-produced shows such as Downton Abbey and Sherlock, and she has a new book out, coming out October 29th, Making Masterpiece, 25 years behind the scenes. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel. It's been great.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell. Irene Noguchi and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Howie Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.